prolific on social media, on Twitter or other platforms, telling the world, wake up, this is happening. Now, they silence all of us. They're just going to quietly get along with it. And I think this is why the dates of the trials are done specifically, because these things are going to start happening by the end of 2026. I would be surprised if you don't see a lot more bombing in Palestine, maybe the destruction of Al-Aqsa Mosque, which I think will make a lot of people gasp. But I do think the collapse of Al-Aqsa Mosque is imminent if they continue their excavations. Maybe all this will happen by the end of 2026 when we've all been silenced and we're unable to report about it. Hopefully somebody will fill in. But at the moment, people are terrified. People are terrified to take over, if you like, posting 30 to 50 tweets per day. It actually takes up your whole day. It's a full-time job. There isn't really anybody else doing it. So all of those investigative journalists, we're all being silenced. And I think we're being silenced for a reason. And the Greater Israel Project is the reason. And it has begun already. I think Francesca Albanese said it's already begun. And I think she's right. But it hasn't begun on a big enough scale that it's noticeable. And so they're getting away with it. And so, yeah, I do fear the amount of arrests that are being made, because they are prolific reporters and activists, and they're the ones that we need to pass on to the next generation, that something big is going down, something bad is happening, and your government is facilitating it. Do something about it. Get out on the streets. There is no ceasefire. This is all a ruse to make you relax. And so, yeah, it's another part of the Rubik's Cube.
Well, with that, I'm afraid we're going to have to call our conversation to an end. I really appreciate the insights that you've been able to give, Sarah, and I want to express my support and solidarity with you. I want to wish you the very best of luck with your case. And I'd ask anyone who's listening to follow you and also your work if they aren't already doing so. Sarah, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you.
See you next time.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to all our listeners. This is Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran, and I'm your host for the next hour. Hope you will accompany us into the early hours of this morning. And here are some interesting facts about Holy Quran. Considered to be a verbal revelation by Allah, this is the actual word of Allah. The Quran is the holiest book for Muslims. Literally meaning, the recitation of the Quran is widely regarded as the finest work in classical Arabic literature. Although the entire holy book plays a significant role in the daily rituals of its followers, the first surah, known as Surah Fatiha, is the most recited of the Holy Quran. The surah, which consists of 7 verses, is repeated in daily prayers of Muslims and on other occasions. Now we'll listen to the translation of this Holy Surah. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, praised be Allah, Lord of the two worlds, this world and the hereafter, the Beneficent, the Merciful, and Master of the Day of Judgment. You alone we do worship, and from you alone we do seek assistance. Guide us to the right path, the path of those to whom you have granted blessings, those who are neither subject to your anger nor have gone astray. We start this hour's lineup with the Ocean of Dua, which gives an explanation of supplications taken from various books, such as Mafatihul Jinan and Kamelu Ziyarat. Our varied radio productions feature will follow next. And our final program this hour is again our radio productions feature. Stay with us into the early hours of this morning.
The Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Murarisi here with another special edition of this program, The Ocean of Dua. In this special edition and during this sacred and holy month of Ramadan, we'll try to talk about some parts of Iftitah supplication, and we'll be bringing you the commentary on some parts of this supplication. We'll be back again after you listen to some parts of this dua, so stay with us.
Alhamdulillah, الذي لا يهتك حجابه ولا يغلق بابه ولا يرد سائله ولا يخيب آمله.
Praise be to Allah. No one can disclose anything hidden by him, and no one can shut the doors kept open by him, and no one who makes a request is sent away disappointed by him.
So you can see that in this part of the dua, the Almighty Allah is saying that he will never reject his servants, he will never close his doors of mercy on them, and he will never allow them to lose hope. But it is possible that out of personal motives, we do something for a person and remind him of this favor. I did it for your sake. But we cannot do this to God because he is aware of our intention and motives. The expression by the will of God is good, but we must be sincere in our words and deeds. Usually, out of the 100 times that we make this expression, only once we truly mean it. As stated in the supplication, if a person really pins his hopes on God, no one who looks long and attentively is deluded in his hopes. So, the conclusion is, if we become hopeless, it is because we have not actually pinned our hope on God, and we haven't actually done our duty with reliance on him. If we like an activity, we do it with great enthusiasm. But if we do not like it, or it requires a lot of effort and patience, either we do not do it, or we do it sluggishly. For example, in doing something, if the means to do that is accessible to us, we tend to do it. Otherwise, we consider it impossible to be done. And we tell everybody, and we inform everyone that we cannot possibly do that because it's impossible to be done. But if we do something with the hope that someone will come to rescue or assist us, but he does not come, we tend to be discouraged in continuing. Even in simple worldly matters, we tend to look for a friend or acquaintance to assist us.
And this only shows that we do not actually pin our hope to God. God has not guaranteed the realization of such hopes. Imam Ali alayhi salam has a very interesting saying about pinning your hope on God. Hazrat Ali alayhi salam has said, يَدَّعِي أَنَّهُ يَرْجُ اللَّهِ. He claimed, according to his own assumptions, he hopes for Allah. كَذَبَ وَالْعَظِيمِ. By Allah the Great he lies. مَا بَالُهُ لَا يَتَبَيَّنُ رَجَاءُهُ فِي عَمَلِهِ. Do not one's hopes become visible through one's actions? فَكُلُّ مَنْ رَجَى عُرِفَ رَجَاءُهُ فِي عَمَلِهِ. The hope of everyone who hopes is known through his own actions. يَرْجُ اللَّهَ فِي الْكَبِيرِ وَيَرْجُ الْعِبَادَ فِي الصَّغِيرِ. He hopes big things from Allah and small things from the man. فَيُعْتِ الْعَبْدَ مَا لَا يُعْتِ الرَّبِّ. But he gives to man such consideration as he does not give to Allah. Then Imam Ali alayhi salam continues, what is the matter with Allah? Glorified be his praise. He is accorded less consideration than what is given to his creatures.
The month of Ramadan is that in which was revealed the Quran, a guidance for the people and clear proofs of guidance and criterion. So whoever cites the new moon of the month, let him fast it, and whoever is ill or on a journey, then an equal number of other days. Allah intends for you ease and does not intend for you hardship, and wants for you to complete the period and to glorify Allah for that to which he has guided you, and perhaps you will be grateful.
So, as you can see, Imam Ali alayhi salam has said that if a person is hopeful of something, he strives to achieve it. Hope urges man to toil and sweat. A youngster who hopes that by obtaining a degree he will find a suitable job and a good social standing will strive hard for years, 24/7, day and night. He can even tolerate being away from home and everything else. Why? Because it is that he has hope. That hope has kept him alive. He hopes that by obtaining a certain degree, he will acquire a suitable job. So it is the hope that produces movement. I mean, if you do have hope, laziness and inertia will go away and you will try and strive hard for obtaining whatever it is you are trying to achieve. This topic is yet to be continued. There are many questions about the hope and having action at the same time that will, inshallah, be answered to in the next programs. Thank you for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to bestow on us the power and bravery to face dreadful events and situations in our lives. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, Take care and goodbye.
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the hall of shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history. Should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. America gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice, our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. The thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too
today, I want to talk about trauma. For 2 years, Palestinians have endured what the UN now officially calls genocide, an era marked by the largest cohort of child amputees in history. 70% of the infrastructure in Gaza has been reduced to rubble. There's been relentless displacement, drone attacks, bombs, snipers shooting toddlers. We all remember 5-year-old Hind Rajab, who was shot hundreds of times as she called for help. The mass graves, the execution of journalist Anas al-Sharif, and hundreds more of his colleagues, as well as health workers. Soldiers taunting starving families, babies abandoned to die in incubators. And the onslaught continues, as does the trauma. UNICEF estimates that nearly every child in Gaza, that's 1.2 million children, needs urgent mental health intervention. And for those of us watching from the outside, this genocide has been live-streamed to our phones between cat memes and bikini thirst traps, none of which can be thought of as accidental in our precisely engineered algorithmic feeds. This is not just brutality. It's the calculated application of political violence and psychological warfare. Tech platforms we depend on are unambiguous about their ties to Israel. TikTok has appointed a former IDF soldier, Erica Mindell, to lead content moderation. At Meta, Guy Rosen, also former IDF, is in charge of integrity. How is Israel, with the aid of these platforms, weaponizing trauma? Are these tech spaces neutral, or have they become tools of surveillance? To help us understand how trauma functions and to reclaim agency, I'm joined by Ashira Darwish, a Palestinian trauma healer and meditation trainer, specializing in trauma shaped by political violence. Ashira has worked alongside leading figures like Dr. Gabor Mate and Dr. Kath Temple, and previously served as a journalist for the BBC. She has also worked at Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International during her years in Palestine. Ashira, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mariam. It's my pleasure.
I guess for people who aren't fully familiar with your journey, can you tell us a little bit about what took you to the work that you do today? Because you've had several phases, haven't you, in your career. So how do you end up a trauma therapist today?
I started my journey as a journalist because I was forced into it in a way. I was in Palestine. I was detained the first time when I was 16 years old. And that detention shaped and changed who I was. I wanted to be a musician. And after that detention, I was like, what musician in this world? And I couldn't unsee the detention center, the police, the system. And I decided I want to be a journalist who helps people. I don't want to be a journalist like the ones who took pictures of me when I was on the floor getting beaten up by soldiers while they were trying to break my knees. So that was the first shift. And I did journalism for years. I was taught by Allah yarhamha Shirin Abu Aqle and some amazing Palestinian teachers in Birzeit University who taught us from the get-go that what you learn in the books has nothing to do with the reality of what you will see on the ground. And all these things that we learn about the protection of journalists and the rights that journalists have, nothing. It doesn't exist in your world because you are black, brown, and you exist in a white supremacist colonial system. Despite that, I still tried my best to fight through the machines and to try to tell our stories. I used every platform possible. I did a reality TV show on YouTube that was aired also on American channels called Sleepless in Gaza and Jerusalem, which is still available now on YouTube, about how life was for Palestinians in all of Palestine and in Gaza. It's thinking about what we filmed then in Gaza and what is now Gaza, it's heartbreaking. And we tried in every modality possible. I did fixing for international journalists. I worked with BBC Media Action. I worked here in the UK with BBC London. And eventually I got to the point where I was like, this is doing nothing. Mm. And at the realm of the BBC, it was very clear that the editorial team is all very patriarchal men who are allied, support, and have very strong connections with Israel. Mm. So it's very hard to break through the system. No matter what the journalists on the ground, how amazing they are, how much they try to get the stories, there's someone on the top. The Palestinians always claim, even if it's a lawyer, even if it's a politician, we claim. And Israelis always state. The IDF states and the Palestinians claim that maybe some people died. The language that is used, everything that is used to suppress our voices. and to support the Zionist entity. And then I thought, okay, maybe human rights. So I went into human rights, thinking that it's different. I worked with Human Rights Watch, with Amnesty International, and I was faced with the same. There's always opposition. During this time, of course, while working with as a journalist, while being just a normal Palestinian, I had my traumas. And it all came to the point where I was injured in Nabi Saleh village, and I was lynched by an Israeli soldier, and my spine was severed. And I was paralyzed. And the Western system also medicinally couldn't help me. They said that you cannot fix a spinal injury, and especially after the spine has been severed 70%. And I had to look for alternatives. And the alternative of that I had, in order to heal my body, I had to heal my mind. And this began my journey in 2012 into starting the journey of healing. And from there, little by little, when I physically healed, I realized that there's so much mentally that I need to heal. And I dealt with my addictions. I uncovered everything that I was hiding and covering with all the adrenaline shocks and running as a journalist and running as a humanitarian and doing all this to also cover a lot of pain that was stuck within my system. And that brought me into the healing world. And through my self journey of healing, after that, I wanted to share it because I realized that there's also in trauma, in our healing, colonization embedded in everything. The Western modality of talk therapy does not work on occupied brown, black bodies, people who have endured indigenous trauma. And I've noticed also in the Western societies that it's not helping people because the body experiences the trauma and the trauma needs to be released from the body itself. And this connection between spiritual and strength and our resilience, this separation that and the individualism that comes from the West is also integral into the therapy world. So I wanted to change that, and I wanted to offer the Palestinians some gateways which are come from us into our healing. And I started Catharsis Holistic Healing as a project, started working with former child prisoners, and then we expanded.
You talked about your detention in Israeli prison and the torture that you've experienced there. You discuss this in a film that we'll get onto in a second. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience of detention in the Israeli system, about the types of things that you experienced there, and what that can help maybe our audience understand about the ways in which the mass detention of Palestinians, including children, is part of a wider system of control?
My first detention was when I was 16, as I said. That was just in a peaceful protest, and I was dragged and beaten up. They tried to break my knees. Then I was punched into a jeep, then harassed and assaulted by the police officer. And the thing that people don't understand is most Palestinian children go through this. And I come from a very privileged background that normally not many of my family members or people from my group endure this experience. But the majority, 99% of Palestinian children, endure some form of harassment and assault by Israeli soldiers. And the detention is what brings on the rest of your life. It changes you, who you are. And the first thing it does is it removes the attachment with your parents. Because at that moment when soldiers are able to take you away from your family, you realize that your family can't help you. And this detachment is very important. For the rest of your life, you're trying to repair the damage that has been done. And what this means also on a political level, I wasn't very politicized. I come from a home that's very politicized, and I wanted to go into music as a way of rejecting. But I knew what was going on, but I wasn't really willing to take an active part until I was detained. And I was like, oh, okay, so this is very personal. And I think what Israel does intentionally is when you take these children, separate them, is it creates a society that's also very much ready to resist and to fight. And they want that. They want us to fight, and they want us to fight while mentally we're not stable. So on a fight, flight, fawn modality where we're just running and trying to do whatever we can to resist. What I would say about my experience is nothing, because I experienced very, very few days in detention, very few moments of what I talk about it in Where the Olive Trees Weep, about the torture in my second arrest.
It's not a small thing.
I know, but this is part of like the Palestinian, like it is big, but in comparison to what my sisters have gone through, and my brothers.
So tell us about that story in context then of what others of people are going through, because you're taken into a shower at a certain point thinking that you're being helped, as it were, because you were having your period at that time, but then the shower turns out to not be a shower.
Yeah, I was basically put in a room where it's hot water and cold water and you can't get out. It's like a coffin and there's nowhere to go. And you're just experiencing whatever. It's that loss of control completely. And the feeling of being also claustrophobic doesn't help. And this is one of the things that I witnessed. I was taken to the rooms where they have the electricity and I was trapped to a chair where there's to be electrocuted, but I wasn't electrocuted. I was just threatened by it. And I saw blood in that room on every single corner. It's like a very white room where you have like blood splits. And listening to the stories of the people who were next to me in the detention, it was just one horror story after the other. And then working with the women prisoners afterwards, sexual harassment, beatings, a lack of sleep. You never know night from day. You don't know. They intentionally try to make sure that you don't sleep at all. So you're sleep deprived. There's no food. And then there's so many different processes. Sometimes they put you in rooms with the informants who speak Arabic to try to get information from you. And there's physical and emotional torture that has been orchestrated. Like somebody, some sick Israeli was sitting and preparing the what methods they're going to use. And they tailor them based on what people. One of my friends sat for 30 days in the interrogation, didn't know any day or light, didn't know who was the interrogators, because they made it. She never went to an actual interrogation room, but she was interrogated the whole time. And she lost part of, like, because of the paranoia, she couldn't recognize what's right and what's wrong. And she dissociated from her whole life. Wow. She didn't recognize her life when she came out, because everything was mixed between the reality and the illusion. So they orchestrate ways. This is other than the physical torture. The stories that we hear now about raping, about using the bottle to rape Palestinian prisoners has been used for years.
I remember hearing about it back when I was there in 2005, it being used, bottles to rape
children.
This
has been used. Palestinian women have been raped. Listen to the stories of Rasmiya Oude, and listen to how the Americans kicked her out of the U.S. because of Israeli pressure. Israel is a master of torture. And they just use different ways to torture people. Palestinian kids that I worked with, the worst one was also house arrest. I was also put in house arrest. And I was put only for one time for 29 days, one time for 15. It breaks the attachment with your parents even further. I hated my mother. She became my jailer. I was like, Mama, I just want to go to the balcony. Like, I'm old. I was 25 or something like that. And she wouldn't let me get on the balcony. And I was like...
Because she was worried about you.
She was worried because they make your parents also sign that they will pay thousands of dollars if you get out. And then they tell them that we will re-arrest them. So your parent becomes the jailer. And I've seen children who are 9 and 8. And I had to, like, take care of, like, go interview them and talk to them in their houses. And they express the same thing. They're like, take us back to jail. At least we're with other prisoners. We know that we're in jail, but I can't stand my mother and my father being the person who does this to me.
You've worked also with some of the children who've come out from Gaza. In fact, you and I both visited some of those children and their families just last year, actually, and I know you've continued working with them. A 2021 Euromed report had shown that 91% of children in Gaza suffered from PTSD as a result of Israeli military attacks. And that was more than 2 years, of course, before the genocide began. A more recent report found that 96% of children feel that their death is imminent, and that might not be just a feeling, sadly. Nearly half say they want to die, which is just, I can't even get my head around that statistic. You've spent considerable time working with these children. What do you observe about the trauma that they've experienced?
I think what people need to understand is the trauma that has happened since the past 2 years, not only to the people in Gaza, to the entire world, is nothing that we have experienced in our lifetimes. It's nothing in comparison to the genocides before, because this is televised. This is on your phone. This is in your home while you're eating. Of course the children in Gaza are going to say they want to die. If I was there, I would want to die too. Why would you want to be in a place that's constantly bombed, where you lose your entire family and you see people you love getting burned alive and the whole world is watching it happen and you're starved to death and you have nowhere safe to go? Of course you'd rather be dead. Yani, there's no logic in wanting to be alive in a place like Gaza. The people who are there, who are still trying to find ways of hope and sing, and these people are angels. They're not normal. There's nothing normal about being in a situation like a genocide and wanting to stay alive. Mm-hmm. And one of the women that we met said she wants to, if we want to help her, we would help her how to kill herself in a way that's Islamically appropriate. She wanted to die. She had one child and she blamed the child for her having to stay alive.
You know, I think people who may be new to the conflict, to the occupation, may not be aware of the extent to which Israel has used psychological warfare against Palestinians for decades throughout the entire occupation. And so when I'm observing certain tactics on the ground, whether that is the continuous displacement, whether that is the airdropping of aid when there are multiple entry points, you know, including by sea, into Gaza, you don't need to drop it by air, or when I observe the food points where people have to walk for miles and then get shot at to get food, like, I think to myself, these things are engineered. These things are by design. And if they are by design, what is the psychological objective of these strategies? Why are the Israelis using these tactics beyond obviously making food itself an act of life and death?
They are engineered completely. They're very smart in torture. And they know exactly how to dehumanize us. Also, having these people running very poor, impoverished, the look of people while they reach to the food centers is already dehumanized to the West.
Mm.
The way they see us, these men running, and the Hunger Games, in a way, the way that they play with us and they taunt us is very much engineered for the West. Mm. So also, it activates adrenaline in people who are watching. There's a part that is trying to push people to want to consume it also. They want to consume the war in Gaza. They want to enjoy it. And you hear videos of Israelis saying, yeah, we like to watch. We want to see. And people are saying, oh, the Israelis don't know. No, they know and they enjoy. There's a way that we're dehumanized. There's a way that they're also forcing us to fight with each other. The way that they're working on the deconstruction of the communities and having people moving back and forth, back and forth. This is all because Israel understood the importance of the tribe for the Palestinians. In 1948, the biggest mistake that was done that made us still resist until today is that our communities weren't dispersed. The refugees left to Lebanon, from Palestine to Lebanon. They stayed in the same streets, in the same neighborhoods, close to each other in the refugee camp. They called the street based on the name of the villages they were ethnically cleansed from, and they still marry until today from the same families. Gaza was a big example of that. It's a big refugee camp, and people maintain the tribe.
Mm.
And the tribe is unbelievably important in times of war. And it's what creates the resilience. It's what creates the generational knowledge. It's what keeps us going strong. So they're fighting that so strongly now and dispersing some families in Egypt, dispersing some families in different places around the world. They're breaking the tribe to break our ability to come back and to resettle.
What about what some of the videos that we are also seeing of Israeli soldiers filming themselves sometimes torturing or tormenting Palestinians? And there's a video that was circulated recently of the soldiers tormenting this poor little boy who must be about, you know, between 9 and 11 years old, small boy. And he's crying and he's actually, you know, completely petrified in this video. And I was thinking to myself again, you know, we had Bassem Youssef on the show a few months ago, and he said, you know, nothing that they put out is, you know, accidental. Nothing that you see put out by IDF soldiers, whether that's them wearing underwear or then that's them looting, is coincidental. It is a part of a deliberate strategy. So how do you interpret these images that are coming out as part of the wider picture of psychological warfare happening?
They're trying to scare people. They're trying to scare people from moving, from acting, from talking in the West Bank and in all of Gaza. Also, the images with the lingerie for the Palestinian man, it's breaking our Palestinian men in knowing that their women, if they're doing this to their clothes, what's going to happen to them if they capture the woman? This is pushing people to move and evacuate when they want them to evacuate, knowing there's a risk that your child will be taunted like that. Also, it means that in the West Bank, the parents will be trying to strangle their children from going out to protest and being in any way active, trying to shut down the televisions, not let them know what's happening in Gaza, and keeping people inside the homes so that nothing happens. The stories of rape didn't come out by accident. The sexual harassment of the Palestinian women prisoners did not come by accident. They're doing this specifically so people, they know our society, they study it, and we have, sadly, people amongst them who are from the society that support them. So they know how to break down the psyche of people.
There are also now, you know, by now, lots of well-documented examples of IDF soldiers, you know, urinating on people, forcing them to act like animals, people being attacked by dogs. There are allegations that have been reported, even The Guardian, of the return of certain people with missing organs, desecration of graves. I mean, as a psychotherapist, looking at the level of depravity that is being exercised by Israeli society. And then, you know, recently we saw, you know, a video coming out from Tel Aviv where people are being asked, like, oh, how's things in Tel Aviv? And they're like, oh, it's so great here. Like, it's a vibe. Like, the food's awesome. How do you make sense of this as a psychotherapist, of this society who can, on one hand, be involved in literally torturing children, shooting them in the head, and come home and, like, party in a G-string and play beach volleyball? Like, how does this work?
This is part of the trauma that the Israelis endure. And the way that the Israeli society operates, they're put in states of fear, constant fear, since the Holocaust until today, especially in Israel. The Jews who are outside had a chance to at least do some healing. The ones who are in the state were given guns, told that this is the Nazis, go after them. And they remain on a state of fight flight since then. And they pass it to generations. They've dehumanized us to the point where they can't see us as humans. And the religion opens the way for that. They have verses that allow for us to be killed, raped, maimed, under the disguise of being strangers and going. The whole society is a sick society, in a sense. And they all need trauma therapy. When you talk about soldiers committing suicide, the violence, and internally, When you're taught as a child to discriminate against one person, you don't recognize that you discriminate only against one. You have the system operation, and the operation works on everybody. So you discriminate also against other people in your community. This is why there's so much racism within the Israeli society, in the different levels of the hierarchy of the Israeli society. They're taught, and this is why you see them when they're coming to suppress protesters now in Tel Aviv. There's severe violence because they can't distinguish. Those who were shooting in the West Bank come back and they're also very violent.
Given the long history of Israeli psyops, and for those who aren't familiar, I would advise you to take a little time out to research how Israel is a leader in psyops. What kind of psyops do you think or do you see already operating in the way that these platforms are curating information or getting us to think about the world? What is it, do you think, that people need to be attentive to from a psychological perspective, from a mental health perspective, about how, you know, very clearly now it's apparent that, you know, pro-Israel voices are working with these platforms where we think we are getting, you know, content directly from the source?
These tools, these platforms are there to share information, but they're not there to liberate us. It's very important for people to send letters to the MPs instead of scrolling. It's very important to be outside asking, and they replace our community. They replace our direct interaction with people. And when activists sit together in community in a meeting, that's when action happens. It's not virtual. We made the mistake in the Arab Revolution. thinking that these platforms will help us, will get to people. But eventually, on the ground, they destroyed us. And having all of our information put out for them to use, we know how they're using the information to target, kill people. For the Palestinians, it's important to get the message out. For those who are on the support, it's important to share their messages 1 hour a day, maximum. To put allocate time for that, for digital activism. But it's not your life. Your activism needs to be on the ground. Your activism needs to be taking Israel into courts. Your activism needs to be directed towards ending the genocide physically. Information is out there about this genocide. It's been 2 years. How are you going to shift somebody's brain? They've seen the trucks of people being loaded out of Gaza. We've seen the flotilla. But we need people to be standing in front of the Israeli embassies to protect the flotilla instead of only sharing on social media. We need people on the ground. And we need to realize that the reason why they allow us to have this gateway is because of that. They want virtual protests, and they want the desensitization of people to images.
Palestine has been recognized by the British government, by the Belgians, by Australia and Canada. This is being heralded as a big moment in the Palestinian liberation struggle. But the genocide is ongoing. And I want to ask you about how you sustain hope and action and cultivate the necessary optimism at a time like this.
I have hope for my children. I have hope in the generation of kids there who, despite it all, still want to sing and dance and still want to make friends and still want to make art and still want to play.
Yeah.
They give me hope, and I have faith, an unwavering faith, yaqeen, in the liberation of Palestine, and it's closer now than we have ever been before. I have faith that we will see Palestine free, and this gives me the hope and the energy to keep going. Every time I try to feel breaking down and I get burned out, and I'm human, I get burned out. I re-engage with all the tools that I have so that I can pick myself up and keep going for the kids and for Palestine and for humanity. It's not only Palestine that we want to liberate. We want to liberate the world. If we liberate Palestine and the Amazon dies, we have a big problem. I want this world that I love to survive, and this gives us the hope. Keep the music alive, I would say to every activist. Keep the Dabke alive. Keep the joy and the love of what you want and what you dream of Palestine to be when we are liberating it. And keep envisioning Palestine as free. See it free. Know that it's going to be free. And just have that. Have that in your heart, in every move that you take.
Ashida, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
Iran Balochistan is populated by over 9,000 villages. The village of Ghalanor dates back to the Qajar period, and since this area isn't prone to earthquakes, the adobe houses have managed to survive for about 150 years. Isn't that amazing? About 40 kilometers from the city of Zobol, this village was originally built on top of a hill and witnessed the migration of the villages of Old Fort. In fact, that's where it gets its name, Ghalanor, which means new fort. Ghalanor was built on high ground to protect its occupants from flood, since the varying amount of the flowing water of the Hamul River has always caused different problems for the people living in the Sistan Basin. But that's not the only thing the architects of this village had up their sleeves. During the Qajar period in the 18th and 19th centuries, different regions were managed by overlords or khans. The most eye-catching structure here is the two-story adobe castle of the Khan of the region. It was built at the entrance of the village and around a small hill, so the top of the hill is the floor of the second story. The village is currently being restored and is going to be turned into an eco-tourism village. Kilometers from Ghalanor lies a mysterious and ancient city referred to over the past 200 to 300 years as Dahaneh Ghulaman, or Gateway of the Slaves. Dahaneh Ghulaman is the largest Achaemenian site in the entire eastern section of Iran that has been dated back to between the 4th and the 6th century BC. More importantly, it's the only Achaemenid site that may hold within its depths the secrets of the lifestyle of the ordinary people living at that time. Built in the wilderness, away from the imperial capital, even with the alignment of buildings roughly in a straight line, running southwest to northeast along the edge of water supplies, the site was only inhabited for a brief period of a century or a century and a half, and was abandoned as a result of natural forces that have always determined the survival and migration of urban settlements in the arid region of Sistan. The entire site was covered by sand. After it was dug up about 50 years ago in the 1960s, the layout of this ancient city was studied extensively by archaeologists from around the world. And it seems that they all came to a similar conclusion. The precise architecture and great harmony in the design of Dahaneh Ghulaman suggests that it was built with urban planning in mind about 2,500 years ago. Geometric studies on this site have revealed 27 major structures and an additional 23 buildings, most of which have not yet been unearthed. It was believed that the Achaemenids used architectural plans only in the construction of palaces and important buildings, such as the royal residences of Pasargad, Persepolis, Susa, as well as Dasht-e Gohar. But it seems that the people of Dahaneh Ghulaman even prepared an architectural plan for the construction of their alleys and ordinary houses. The urban planning, the architecture, the temple, the location and size of what remains of this ancient city have led scholars to believe that it was a satrapal capital or something very similar to it in character. Studies into the origins of the hearths, fireplaces and altars have tried to reveal their purpose since they have a unique architecture. Were they used for animal sacrifices since animal blood was found on the altars? What kind of rituals were performed here? All these studies have tried to find answers to the many questions that arose 40 years ago with the unearthing of the site and have never been completely answered, even to this day. Standing atop the nearby hill that gives you an overview of the site, you can see lakes filled with a considerable amount of water around it. The Chaimime reservoirs in the south of Zobol are three big lakes that are the second most important water storage reservoirs in the region. The water stored in these big lakes
is used to irrigate the Sistan Plain and to provide drinking water for the cities of Zabol and Zahedan.
Trees were planted all around the lakes by the University of Zabol to prevent dust from falling into the water. This is Golnar Farnoudi for Iran.
Behind this beautiful old wooden door lies an ancient civilization, a wealth of cultural, artistic, and religious jewels that portray the civilization of a nation.
The Qom Astana Museum, located in the city of Qom, right near the holy shrine of Fatima Masuma, sister of Imam Riza, opened up its doors to the public back in 1935. The museum has an area of 1,000 square meters with two floors hosting two exhibition halls. More than 1,000 artifacts and objects of artistic, cultural, and historical value are displayed here. These treasures belong to different periods in history, from the 1st and 2nd millennium BC to the Islamic era in the country. The museum displays a wide range of objects and artifacts, varying from paintings, chinaware, ceramics and pottery, to priceless handmade rugs, glassware and precious Qurans.
Museum near to the shrine of Fatima Masura. It's wonderful to look around this museum, particularly to look at the carpet, beautiful carpet, and with the silk, beautifully designed. And also, I look around some other places to look at the Quran, the oldest Quran from the 9th century to the present time. It's amazing to keep those kind of like traditional symbolic teachings of Prophet Muhammad.
The crown jewel of Iran's handicraft industry is its beautiful handmade rugs and carpets. Excavations in Iran have revealed that this art dates back to the 1st and 2nd millennium BC. The treasured silk rugs in this museum are valuable for their extraordinary designs, rich combination of colors, and excellent texture. One of the main features of Islamic architecture is the gorgeous glazed tiles that decorate the interior and exterior of the buildings. This art form reached new heights during the 14th century when the Timurid Empire ruled the country. The oldest tiles in this museum belong to the Seljuk era, some 12 centuries ago.
Beautiful doors opened up to. There must have been a beautiful heaven behind these doors that inspired the artist to create wonders on these beautiful creations.
The decorated doors displayed here date back to different time periods, but all adorned beautifully with different artistic techniques. Some are decorated with the art of marquetry, wood inlaying and wood carving with delicate pieces of ivory, bone, brass, gold and silver sections. Others are made with metal, embellished with inscriptions written by the best calligraphers of the time.
size isn't really an issue when it comes to narrating history. Some items here in this museum are quite small in size, but